Chapter 8. "Do you see that, Weber?" Rabich asked. "Here, and here, and here." Weber bent over the clamped-open incision. "Yes." "These small nodules here, and here. That's not a swelling, nor is it an adhesion." "No." Rabich straightened up. "Cancer," he said. "A clear, unmistakable case of cancer. This is the damnedest operation I've performed in years. The speculum doesn't show anything. The pelvic examination, an insignificant softness at one side only, a slight swelling, the possibility of a cyst or of a fibroma, nothing of importance. But we have to make an abdominal approach, so we cut and suddenly find a carcinoma." Weber looked at him. "What do you want to do?" "We can make a frozen section, to get a microscopic report. Is Boisson still in the laboratory?" "Certainly." Weber gave an order to the infirmière to call up the laboratory. She went out quickly on noiseless rubber soles. "We should go on cutting," Rabich said. "Do a hysterectomy. There's no point in doing anything else. The damnedest part of it is that she doesn't know. How's the pulse?" he asked the anaesthetist. "Regular, 90. Blood pressure, 120. "All right." Rabich looked at Kate Hegstrom's body, which, head low, lay on the operating table in the Trendelenburg position. "She should know beforehand. She should give her consent. We simply can't just go ahead like this. Or can we?" "Not according to the law. On the other hand, we have already begun." "Well, that we had to do. We could not do the abortion without an abdominal approach. This is quite another operation. To remove the uterus is different from an abortion." "I believe she trusts you, Rabich." "I don't know. Maybe. But would she agree?" He adjusted the rubber apron under the white coat with his elbow. "Nevertheless, first I could try to explore further. Then we can still decide whether to do the hysterectomy. Knife, Eugenie." He lengthened the incision to the navel and clamped the smaller blood vessels. Then he stopped a larger one with double knots, took another knife, and cut through the yellow fascia. He fixed the muscles underneath with the back of the knife, then he pulled up the peritoneum, opened, and clipped it. "The retractor." The assistant nurse held it ready. She threw the weighted chain between Kate Hegstrom's legs and hooked on the bladder plate. "Dressings?" He pressed in the damp, warm dressing, laid open the abdominal cavity, and carefully applied the grasping forceps. Then he glanced up. "Look here, Weber. And here, the broad ligament. This thick, hard mass. Impossible to apply the Coker forceps. It has gone too far." Weber stared at the spot which Rabich pointed out. "Look at that," Rabich said. "We cannot clamp the arteries. Brittle. It's spreading here, too. Hopeless." He carefully snipped off a small piece. "Is Boisson in the laboratory?"
"Yes," the infirmière said. "I have telephoned. He is waiting."
"All right. Have this sent to him. We can wait for the report. It won't take more than 10 minutes. "Tell him to telephone," Weber said. "Immediately. We'll suspend the operation." Rabich straightened up. "How is the pulse?"
95.
"Blood pressure?"
115.
"All right. Weber, we don't need to decide whether to operate with or without consent. There's nothing more we can do." Weber nodded. "We'll have to sew her up," Rabich said. "Remove the fetus, that's all. Sew her up and say nothing." He stood there for a moment and looked at the open body beneath the white sheets. The piercing light made the sheets appear even whiter, like new fallen snow, under which yawned the red crater of the gaping wound. Kate Hegstrom, 34 years old, capricious, slender, tanned, filled with the will to live, sentenced to death by this nebulous, invisible touch that was destroying her tissues. He bent over the body again. "We still have to..." The child. A groping life, blind, still grew in this disintegrating body, doomed with it. Still feeding, sucking, eager, only a drive toward growth. Something that would one day want to play in gardens, that would want to become somebody, an engineer, a priest, a soldier, a murderer, a human being, something that would want to live, to suffer, to be happy and to go to pieces. The instrument carefully slid along the invisible wall, found the resistance, broke it cautiously, removed it, ended it. Ended the unconscious struggles, ended the unbreathed breath, the unlived joyousness, lamentations, growth. Nothing now but a bit of dead, pallid flesh and dripping blood. Any report from Boisson yet?
Not yet. It should be here any minute now.
We can wait another few minutes. Ravitch stepped back. Pulse? He glanced over the shield into Kate Hegstrom's eyes. They were open, and she looked at him. Not with a glazed expression, but as if she saw him and knew everything. For a moment he thought she was conscious. He took a step forward and halted. Impossible. What was he thinking of? It was an accident, the light. The pupils had reacted to light during the narcosis.
How is her pulse?
100. Blood pressure 112. It's going down.
Time's getting short, Ravitch said. Boisson should be ready by now.
There was the subdued ringing of the telephone downstairs. Weber turned toward the door. Ravitch did not look up. He waited. He heard the door being opened. The nurse entered.
Yes, Weber said.
Carcinoma. Ravitch nodded and went back to work. He lifted the forceps and the clips. He removed the retractor, the dressings. Eugénie, at his side, mechanically counted the instruments. He began stitching, lightly, methodically, painstakingly, completely concentrated and without a single thought. The grave closed. The layers of flesh were drawn together to the last, outermost one. He put on the clips for the skin and straightened up.
Finished.
Eugénie stepped on the lever, bringing the operating table to a horizontal position, and covered Kate Hegstrom.
Scheherazade, Ravitch thought, the day before yesterday. Address from Meinbacher. Have you ever been happy?
Often. I'm afraid. A routine matter. Let the gypsies play. He looked at the clock above the door. 12 o'clock. Noon. Outside, office and factory doors were opening now, and healthy people streaming out. Lunchtime. The two nurses rolled the level stretcher out of the operating room. Ravitch tore the rubber gloves from his hands, went into the washroom, and began to wash.
Your cigarette, Weber said, washing himself at the other basin. You'll burn your lips.
Yes, thanks.
Who will tell her, Weber?
You will, Weber declared unhesitatingly.
We'll have to explain to her why we had to operate. She expected us to do it from the inside. We can't tell her what it really was.
Something will occur to you, Weber said confidently.
You think so?
Of course. After all, you've got until tonight.
And you?
She wouldn't believe anything I'd say. She knows that you operated, and she'll want to hear about it from you. She would only be suspicious if I told her.
That's right.
I still don't understand it, Weber said. How could it develop in such a short time?
It can. I wish I knew what to tell her.
You'll think of something, Ravitch. A cyst of some sort, or a fibroma.
Yes, Ravitch said. Some sort of cyst or fibroma.
At night he went to the hospital again. Kate Hegstrom was sleeping. She had awakened in the evening, had vomited, spent a restless hour, and had then fallen asleep again.
Did she ask anything?
No, said the red-cheeked nurse. She was still drowsy and asked no questions.
I think she'll sleep until morning. In case she wakes up and asks questions, tell her everything went well. She's to go back to sleep. Give her something, if necessary. If she should become restless, call Dr. Weber or me. I'll leave word at the hotel where to find me.
He stood in the street like someone who had for once escaped. A few hours' grace before he had to lie to a trusting face. Suddenly the night seemed warm and shimmering. The grey scab of life was once again mercifully covered over by a few borrowed hours which flew up like doves. They too were lies. One had to pay for everything. They were a postponement only. But what wasn't? Was not everything postponement? Merciful postponement? a bright flag which covered the remote, black, inexorably nearing gate. He went into a bistro and took a seat at one of the marble tables at the window. The room was smoky and full of noise. The waiter came. A Dubonnet and a package of colonials. He opened the package and lighted one of the black cigarettes. At the table next to him, some Frenchmen were discussing their corrupt government and the Munich Pact. Ravitch only half listened. Everyone knew that the world was apathetically sliding into a new war. No one did anything to stop it. Postponement. Another year's postponement. That was all they managed to struggle for. Postponement here, too, again and again. He emptied the glass of Dubonnet. The sweetish, dull flavour of the aperitif filled his mouth with a flat distaste. Why had he ordered it? He called the waiter. Affine! He looked through the window and shook his thoughts off. If there was nothing to be done, one shouldn't drive oneself crazy. He recalled the time when he had learned this lesson, one of the great lessons of his life. It was in August 1916, near Ypres. The company had returned from the front the day before. It had been a quiet section in which they were used for the first time since they had been sent into the field. Nothing had happened. Now they were lying in the warm August sun around a small fire, frying potatoes they had found in the fields. A minute later, nothing was left. A sudden artillery attack, a shell had hit the middle of the fire. When he came to himself again, whole, uninjured, he found two of his comrades dead. And farther away his friend, Messman, whom he had known from the time when both began to walk, with whom he had played, gone to school, from whom he had been inseparable, lying there with his belly torn open, his intestines coming out. They carried him on a tent litter to the field hospital, by the nearest path, through a cornfield, up a slope. Four men carried him, one at each corner, and he was lying in the brown tent litter, his hands pressed against the white, fat, bloody intestines, his mouth open, his eyes uncomprehendingly fixed. 2 hours later he died. For one of them he had screamed. Ravitch remembered how they had returned. He had sat in the barracks, dull and bewildered. It was the first time he had seen anything like that. Kaczynski had found him there, the group leader, a shoemaker in private life. "Come," he had said. "They have beer and whiskey in the Bavarian canteen today. Sausages, too." Ravitch had stared at him. He could not understand such callousness. Kaczynski had watched him for a while. Then he had said, "You are coming with me, even if I have to beat you up. Today you'll eat and get drunk and go to a cat house." He had not answered. Kaczynski had sat down beside him. "I know what's the matter with you. I know, too, what you think of me now. But I have been here 2 years, and you 2 weeks. Listen, can anything still be done for Messman?" "No. Don't you know that we would risk everything if there were a chance to save him?" He had looked up. Yes, he knew that. He knew that about Kaczynski. "Well, he is dead. There is nothing to be done any more. But in 2 days we'll have to get out of here for the front. This time it won't be so quiet there. Crouching here now and thinking of Messman, the thing eats into you, ruins your nerves, makes you jittery. Perhaps just enough to slow you down during the next attack out there. Just half a second late. Then we carry you back as we did Messman. Whom does it help? Messman? No. Someone else? No. It kills you, that's all. Now do you understand?" "Yes, but I can't—" "Shut up, you can. Others could, too. You aren't the first." It had become better after that night. He had gone with him. He had learned his first lesson. Help when you can. Do everything, then. But when you can no longer do anything, forget it. Turn away. Pull yourself together. Compassion is meant for quiet times, not when life is at stake. Bury the dead and devour life. You'll still need it. Mourning is one thing, facts are another. One doesn't mourn less when one sees the facts and accepts them. That's how one survives. Ravitch drank his cognac. The Frenchmen at the next table were still talking about their government, about France's failure, about England, about Italy, about Chamberlain. Words, words. The only ones who did something were the others. They were not stronger, only more determined. They were not braver. They only knew that the others wouldn't fight. Postponement. But what did they do with it? Did they arm themselves? Did they make up for lost time? Did they pull themselves together? They watched the others going ahead arming themselves and waited, passively hoping for a new postponement. The story of the herd of seals. Hundreds of them on a beach, among them the hunter killing one after the other with a club. Together they could easily have crushed him, but they lay there, watching him come to murder, and did not move. He was only killing a neighbor, one neighbor after the other. The story of the European seals, the sunset of civilization. Tired, shapeless, Götterdämmerung. The empty banners of human rights, the sellout of a continent, the onrushing deluge, the haggling for the last prices, the old dance of despair on the volcano, peoples again being slowly driven into a slaughterhouse. The fleas would save themselves when the sheep were being sacrificed, as always. Ravitch pressed out his cigarette. He looked around. What did it all mean? Hadn't the evening been like a dove before, like a soft, grey dove? Bury the dead and devour life. Time is short. To survive was everything. A time would come when one was needed. One should keep oneself whole and ready for that. He called the waiter and paid. The lights in the Scheherazade were lowered when he entered. The gypsies were playing, and the spotlight flooded the table beside the orchestra where Joan Madou sat. Ravitch stopped inside the door. One of the waiters approached him and moved a table into position, but Ravitch remained standing and looked at Joan Madou. "Vodka?" the waiter asked. "Yes, a carafe." Ravitch sat down. He poured vodka into his glass and drank it quickly. He wanted to get rid of the thoughts he had had outside. The grimace of the past and the grimace of death, a belly torn open by shells and one eaten up by cancer. He noticed that he was sitting at the same table where he had sat with Kate Hegstrom 2 days before. Another table was vacated beside him. He did not move there. It made no difference. Whether he was sitting at this table or at the next, it did not help Kate Hegstrom. What had Weber said once? "Why do you get upset when an operation is hopeless? You do what you can and you go home. Otherwise, where would it lead?" Yes, where would it lead? He heard Joan Madou's voice coming from the orchestra. Kate Hegstrom was right. It was an agitating voice. He reached for the carafe with the limpid brandy. One of those moments when colours fade and life turns grey under powerless hands. The mystic ebb, the silent caesura between breaths. The bite of time slowly consuming one's heart. "Santa Lucia Lontana," sang the voice by the orchestra. It came to him as though across an ocean, from a forgotten far shore where something bloomed. "How do you like her?" "Whom?" Ravitch glanced up. The manager stood at his side. He motioned to Joan Madou. "Much, very much. She isn't exactly a sensation, but quite good between the other numbers." The manager moved along. For a moment his pointed beard stood out black against the white light. Then he disappeared in the darkness. The spotlight died away. The orchestra began to play a tango. The illuminated table plates emerged again, and above them the blurred faces. Joan Madou rose and made her way among the tables. She had to stop several times because couples were going to the dance floor. Ravitch looked at her and she looked at him. Her face betrayed no surprise. She came straight toward him. He got up and pushed the table aside. A waiter came to his aid. "Thanks," he said. "I'll do it myself. All we need is another glass." He moved the table back again and filled the glass which the waiter had brought. "Here, this is vodka," he said. "I don't know whether you drink that."
"Yes. We have drunk it before, in the Belle Aurore."
"That's right. We were here before, too," he thought. "Ages ago. 3 weeks ago. Then you were sitting here in your raincoat, huddled, nothing but a bit of misery and defeat in the half-dark. Now—"
"Salute," he said.
A gleam crossed her face. She did not smile, only her face became brighter. "I haven't heard that for a long time," she said. "Salut." He emptied the glass and looked at her. The high brows, the wide-set eyes, the mouth, all that had formerly been blurred and separate, without context, now combined to shape a bright, mysterious face, a face whose openness was its secret. It neither hid nor revealed anything. It promised nothing, and thereby everything. "Odd. I haven't seen this before," he thought. But perhaps it was not there. Perhaps it was then completely filled with confusion and fear. "Have you a cigarette?" Joan Madou asked. "Only the Algerians, those with the strong black tobacco." Ravitch was about to call the waiter. "They are not too strong," Joan Madou said. "Once you gave me one, on the Pont de l'Alma." "That's true." "It is true and it isn't true," he thought. "That was a pale, hunted creature, not you. There were many other things as well between us, and suddenly none of them is true any longer." "I was here once before," he said. "Day before yesterday."
"I know. I saw you."
She didn't ask about Kate Hegstrom. She sat in the corner, calm and relaxed, and smoked, and was completely absorbed in her smoking. Then she drank, calmly and slowly, and was completely absorbed in her drinking. She seemed to do everything she did wholly, however unimportant it was. At that time she was completely desperate, too, Ravitch thought, and now she wasn't at all any more. Suddenly she had warmth and a self-evident, assured placidity. He did not know whether it was due to the fact that nothing moved her life at the moment. He only felt it shine unpremeditatedly upon him. The carafe of vodka was empty. "Shall we go on drinking the same?"
"What was it you gave me to drink then?"
"When? Here? I think we mixed them all up."
"No, not here. That first evening."
Ravitch reflected. "I can't remember any more. Wasn't it cognac?"
"No. It looked like cognac, but it was something else. I tried to get it, but I couldn't."
"Why do you want it? Was it so good?"
"Oh, not because of that. It was the warmest thing I ever drank in my life."
"Where did we drink it?"
"In a small bistro near the Arc. We had to go down a few steps. Cab drivers and a few girls were there. The waiter had a woman tattooed on his arm."
"Oh, now I know. It must have been Calvados, apple brandy from Normandy. Have you tried that?"
"I don't think so."
Ravitch called the waiter. "Have you any Calvados?"
"No, sorry. No one ever asks for it."
"This place is too elegant for it. It must have been Calvados. It's a shame we can't find out. The simplest thing would be to go to that place again, but that's not possible now."
"Why?"
"Don't you have to stay here?"
"No, I'm through."
"Fine. Do you want to go there?"
"Yes."
Ravitch had no trouble finding the bistro. It was fairly empty. The waiter with the woman tattooed on his arm glanced at each of them in turn. Then he shuffled out from behind his counter and wiped a table. "This is progress," Ravitch said. "He didn't do that then."
"Not this table," Joan Madou said. "That one, there."
Ravitch smiled. "Are you superstitious?"
"Sometimes."
The waiter stood beside them. "Well, that's it," he said, making the tattooing jump. "That's where you sat last time. Do you still remember?" "Perfectly." "You should be a general," Ravitch said, "with such a memory." "I never forget anything." "Then I wonder how you can live. But do you also remember what we drank last time?" "Calvados," the waiter said, without hesitating. "Right. We'd like to repeat it now." Ravitch turned to Joan Madou. "How simply problems are solved sometimes. Now we'll see if it tastes just the same." The waiter brought the glasses. "Double. You ordered double Calvados, then." "You're gradually giving me an uncanny feeling, my good man. Do you also remember how we were dressed?" "Raincoats. The lady wore a Basque beret." "It's a pity you have to be here. You belong in vaudeville." "I used to be," the waiter replied, astonished. "Circus. I told you that. Did you forget?"
Yes. It's disgraceful, but I did.
This gentleman has a bad memory, Joan Madou said to the waiter. He is an expert in forgetting, just as you are an expert in not forgetting.
Ravitch glanced up. She looked at him. He smiled. Perhaps not, after all, he said. And now we'll taste the Calvados. Salut.
Salut.
The waiter remained standing. What one forgets one misses later in life, sir, he declared. The topic was not yet exhausted, as far as he was concerned. Correct. And what one doesn't forget makes one's life a hell. Well, not mine. It's gone. Then how can it make one's life a hell? Ravitch glanced up. Just because of it, brother. But you are a happy man, not just an artist. Is it the same Calvados? He asked Joan Madou.
It is better.
He looked at her. He felt a warmth rising in him. He knew what she meant, but it was disarming that she said it. She did not seem to be concerned with what effect it might have. She sat in this bare-looking place as if she were all by herself. The light from the unshaded electric bulbs was merciless. Under them, two whores sitting a few tables away looked like their own grandmothers. But the glare had no effect on her. What had shone before in the subdued light of the nightclub held its own here, too. The cool, bright face, which didn't ask for anything, which simply existed, waiting. It was an empty face, he thought, a face that could change with any wind of expression. One could dream into it anything. It was like a beautiful empty house waiting for carpets and pictures. It had all possibilities. It could become a palace or a brothel. It depended on the one who filled it. How limited by comparison was all that is already completed and labelled. He noticed that she had emptied her glass. "My respects," he said. "That was a double Calvados. Do you want another one?"
"Yes, if you have time."
"Why shouldn't I have time?" he thought. Then it occurred to him that she had seen him with Kate Hegstrom last time. He looked up. Her face didn't betray anything. "I have time," he said. "I have to operate tomorrow at 9, that's all."
"Can you do it if you stay up so late?"
"Yes. This has nothing to do with it. It's habit. Nor do I operate every day." The waiter refilled their glasses. He brought a package of cigarettes with the bottle and put it on the table. It was a package of Laurent Green. "These are what you had last time, aren't they?" he asked Ravitch triumphantly. "I have no idea. You know more than I do. I believe you."
"He's right," Joan Madou said. "It was Laurent Green."
"You see, the lady has a better memory than you have, sir." "That's yet to be proved. Anyway, we can use the cigarettes." Ravitch opened the package and held it out to her. "Do you still live in the same hotel?" he asked.
"Yes, only I took a larger room."
A few cab drivers entered. They sat down at one of the nearby tables and began a loud discussion. "Would you like to leave?" Ravitch asked. She nodded. He called the waiter and paid. "Are you sure you don't have to go back to the Scheherazade?"
"No."
He took her coat. She did not put it on. She simply hung it around her shoulders. It was an inexpensive mink, possibly an imitation, but it did not look cheap on her. Only what is not worn with assurance is cheap, Ravitch thought. He had seen cheap crown sables. "Now I'll take you to your hotel," he said, when they stood outside the entrance in the light drizzle. She turned toward him slowly.
"Aren't we going to your place?"
Her face was just below his, partly turned up to him. The light from the lamp in front of the door shone full on it. Fine beads of moisture glittered on her hair. "Yes," he said. A taxi approached and stopped. The driver waited a while. Then he clicked his tongue, the gears grated, and he drove away.
"I've been waiting for you. Did you know?" she asked.
"No." Her eyes gleamed in the light from the street lamp. One could look through them and see no end. "I've seen you today for the first time," he said. "You are not the same woman as before."
"No."
"And all that was before never happened?"
"No. I have forgotten it."
He felt the light ebb and flow of her breath. Invisibly and tenderly it was vibrating toward him, without heaviness, ready and full of confidence. A strange life in a strange night. Suddenly he felt his blood. It mounted and mounted, and it was more than that. Life, a thousand times cursed and welcomed, often lost and re-won. An hour ago still a barren landscape, arid, full of rocks and without consolation. And now gushing, gushing as if from many fountains, resounding and close to the mysterious moment in which one had not believed any more. One was the first man again. On the shore of the ocean and out of the waves emerged, white and radiant, question and answer in one. It mounted and mounted, and the storm began above his eyes. "Hold me," she said. He looked down into her face and put his arm around her. Her shoulders came closer to him like a ship coming to anchor in a harbour. "Must one hold you?" he asked. "Yes." Her hands lay close together against his chest. "I'll hold you," he said. She nodded. Another taxi came to a squeaking stop beside the curb. The driver, unmoved, looked over at them. On his shoulder sat a little dog in a knitted vest.
"Taxi!"
he croaked from behind a long flaxen moustache. "Look," Ravitch said, "that man knows nothing. He doesn't know that wings have touched us. He looks at us and doesn't see that we have changed. That is the crazy thing about the world. You may turn into an archangel, a fool, or a criminal. No one will see it. But when a button is missing, everyone sees that."
"It is not crazy. It is good so. It leaves us to ourselves."
Ravitch looked at her. "Us," he thought. "What a word. The most mysterious in the world."
"Taxi!"
The driver croaked patiently, but louder, and lit a cigarette.
"Come," Ravitch said. "He won't let us go. He is experienced in his trade."
"I don't want to ride. Let's walk."
"It is beginning to rain."
"That isn't rain. That is mist. I don't want a taxi. I want to walk with you."
"All right. But I'd like to make that man understand that something has happened here."
Ravitch walked over and spoke to the driver. The man smiled a beautiful smile, greeted Joan with a gesture that Frenchmen alone achieve at such moments, and drove away.
"How did you explain it to him?"
she asked when Ravitch returned.
"With money. The simplest thing. Like all people who work nights, he's a cynic. He understood immediately. He was benevolent, with a touch of amiable contempt."
She smiled. He put his arm around her shoulders. She leaned against him. He felt something open up in him and spread, warm and soft and wide. Something that drew him down as though with many hands, and made it suddenly unbearable that they were standing side by side on their feet, those small platforms, absurdly upright, balancing, instead of forgetting and sinking down, yielding to the call of the skin, the call behind the millenniums when there did not as yet exist brains and thoughts and suffering and doubt, but only the dark happiness of the blood.
"Come," he said.
They walked along the empty grey street through the light rain, and when they reached its end, the square lay before them again, huge and unbounded, and, out of the flowing silver, suspended aloft, rose the massive greyness of the Arc.